Broadcasting from Manhattan Beach and the World Wide Web, you're listening to CHSR, HealthyLife.net.
As a service to our listeners, this program is for general information and entertainment purposes only. CHSRHealthyLife.net does not recommend, endorse, or object to the views, products, or topics expressed or discussed by show hosts or their guests. We suggest you always consult with your own personal, medical, financial, or legal advisor.
Welcome to CenterPoint. I'm your host, Dr. Ron Anbar. In this show, we will discuss ways that we can journey to our own centers. This can help us access our inner resources to improve our physical abilities and health, our mental strength, our emotional well-being, and our spirituality. Today, I'm very glad to welcome back to our show, David Godot. Hello, David.
Hello, Ron. So nice to talk with you again.
Yeah, we had so much fun the first show, I thought we'd do it again. Let me remind the audience who you are. So David Godot is a psychologist based out of Long Beach, California. He is the owner and clinical director of a psychotherapy group practice called Psych Lab Psychology Center, which is a training practice focused on collaborative learning and deliberate practice of relational psychotherapy with an emphasis on mindfulness, mentalization, and attachment repair. And as David and I were discussing what we would talk about today, David has an interest in Buddhism and Buddhist psychology, as well as mindfulness and therapy. So without further ado, David, do you want to introduce us? Tell what is Buddhist psychology? Let's start with that.
That's a great question, because I think that the Buddhist philosophy, which many people in the West think of as being a religion in the same sense as Christianity or Judaism or Islam, is actually more of a psychological system as it was developed. Not always as it's practiced. There are, of course, sects that have their dogmas and rituals and things like this. But Buddhist psychology is premised on the question of what is it that you mean when you say I? What is it? What is the nature of consciousness and self? And so, when we raise this question for ourselves, there's basically only one way to study it, which is, if you want to, as Sam Harris says, if you want to understand the mind, sit down and pay attention to it. And when you pay close attention to the operations of your own mind in real time, you begin to find some very unusual some very unusual things that are out of step with what is the common wisdom about how our lives are experienced. And that basic insight tends to be that, well, there is nobody in the chair of consciousness, that here are all these experiences happening, and we have the sense that, well, here I am, this self, having these experiences. But if I really try to pay attention phenomenologically to, well, what is the experiencer? Who is this observing self? There doesn't seem to be one separate from the observation, separate from the experience. It appears that that this construct of self is the product of mind, is a concept that is strung together as a way of making sense out of this ongoing flow of experience. And so better thought of as a wave moving across the surface of the ocean rather than an object to be acted upon by its environment.
So just to clarify, here we are going through life having experiences, whatever we are, and you're saying there's no I with experience, and you're saying it's just an experience, and then we interpret an I?
Yeah, and I think this goes to a deeper issue that's very relevant to the issue of hypnosis, which I think is close to both of our hearts, which, you know, fundamentally, I think my fascination with hypnosis has always revolved around this question of language. How do we represent and shape our experienced reality? And the linguistic conventions, particularly in English, fall around reification, around kind of thingifying all of these processes that are in flux. So I say that, well, I am a person, and that sounds like a thing, and you can sort of pluck me out of my environment, but I won't last very long if you do, you know. And how can we, where does my personage end and the environment begin? Well, in a physiological way, that's pretty fuzzy because I'm constantly having to take in elements of the environment and incorporate them into my cellular structure and excrete elements of my internal functioning out into the world. And psychologically, the same is true, where it would be very difficult to say, well, who would I have been had I had a whole different set of experiences? Would that even be the same person? And not only that, but I seem to become a different person as experience unfolds. And so if we really break down the idea of what is a person, you can only freeze it in time within one moment. And it's, we connect one moment to the next and say, well, that's the same person from one moment to the next. But that connection between moments in time is really a concept that our mind must construct. There's no basis for that other than our sense of continuity and need to manifest that sense of continuity in order to, to achieve organismic goals. And the organismic goals themselves are goals of the environment. You know, we operate, as Terence McKenna said, less as individual species and more as a kind of a gene swarm that can only really be understood from a very broad perspective. And the operations of individual organisms often seem quite mysterious if we try to break them apart from one another.
But if I look at you from the outside, I'll identify you as the same person as I met a few months ago. Is that not just you who think you're the same person? I think you're the same person, too. Is that not true?
Yeah. Yeah, because our minds are of a similar nature to tie together, linearly through time, the progression of things. But, I use the metaphor of like a wave. Well, so I can watch a wave move across the surface of the ocean from point A to point B, and I can clearly identify in my mind, here is a distinct entity, here is a thing. But is there any way to practically, apart from the concepts that I hold in my mind of what a wave is, to separate that from the ocean? In fact, there isn't a separate thing that is the wave. The wave is a property of the emergent energies within the ocean. And if I try to pick it up and move it to another location, take it to the laboratory or something, I will have destroyed it. There will be no more wave. Because what I saw as the motion through that body of water and my mind made into a thing was actually a verb. It was a process. It was something that can only be witnessed in motion. And I think that the same is true for living beings.
Do you think that's true for both our physical and psychological parts?
I do. And I think that there's been a lot of neuroscientific research on, to try to address this hard problem of consciousness, of why should there be consciousness? What is the nature of consciousness? And the more we look into the functioning of the brain, I was just thinking about this morning. We think about memories and dreams and ideas the same way, as though it were this thing that occurs in the mind. But if I really attend to and break down experientially, what does it mean to have a memory? The memory is not, in fact, a thing. It is, from a neurological perspective, it is a pattern of associative, sympathetic firing through a network within the brain that trigger simultaneously a wide array of conscious and unconscious experiences, which the mind draws together and stitches into something discernible as a discrete experience. But trying to zero in on the memory, it falls apart, you know, much the same way that, it's come to be very well established that eyewitness testimonies are extremely unreliable because the very act of examining them changes them. Our minds are not recorders, you know, of accurate information, but are imprinters of subtle impressions of different wavelengths of energy that we are tuned to create associations between. And I think when we think about a memory, it's a very common experience to have a memory get crossed up with another memory. We'll be talking about somebody who had the same experience and have very, disparate opinions about how things unfolded. And you may later realize, I was thinking about part of this was coming from something else. Part of this was just something I was thinking about. And so a lot of the activity of our conscious minds, I think, is trying to sort through that huge associative pool of information that the unconscious is sort of collecting and processing. And even, I reify the unconscious when I say it like that. I talk about it as though it's this thing, this sort of undermind that's doing, you know, some sort of conscious operation. When actually I think there's... it's better thought of as like the organism of the earth, you know, like the floor of a forest. Here are endless complexities of different types of cells and even organisms that have been incorporated into the overarching organism in the form of mitochondria, organisms which have not been fully incorporated into the larger organism, but are which are very symbiotic and necessary, like all the millions of species of bacteria that we haven't even studied, types of cells that we haven't even fully come to understand or recognize, the different microglia and things of this nature. And I think that our minds simplify and it's comfortable to look at all of this huge arrangement and say, oh, well, look, there is a mind, as though that were a thing that you could sort of download into a computer. And I think that this leads to lots of really weird questions that people ask, like, oh, well, can you download your consciousness into a computer? Will they be able to do that someday? And this comes from a fundamental misunderstanding of what experience is, I think, that the experience is the existence of the neurological apparatus. And the neurological apparatus is the existence of the organism within the world. The world is the experience of the universe. As Alan Watts would say, we think of ourselves as this thing at the end of a long process originating from a big bang, and sort of at the tail end of this, here are these manifestations. And you say, well, actually, you are the Big Bang. It is still happening. And your experience of being a self is the continuance of that exact same process.
But my experience or my sense of self, whatever it is based in my experience. Like the memories are based on experiences this organism that I call myself has had.
Yeah.
And so, again, that's actually where hypnosis is very interesting because you can use a state of mind that we call trance to change interpretation of past experience, even change perhaps the memory of a past experience. And then the person we call the person changes in some way. They, You've done that for
right.
patients.
Yes, you can see profound personality changes. Someone once said, it's never too late to have a happy childhood. And we have found that you can rewrite even some very traumatic memories in a very tangible and really profoundly impactful way. Dan Brown did a tremendous amount of work on this with his ideal parent figure protocol. And
so do you think when we do that, the result is a different person, whatever that is? Or is it, are we the same person, or have we now changed in a fundamental way?
Well, I think the question itself sort of points toward this linguistic trickery that I was talking about. The convention of our language is to make a thing out of the person. And you bring up a very interesting example of where that falls apart. If experience changes me, changes my personality, changes my orientation and stance towards the world, changes my way of perception, am I the same person or am I a different person? We might as well ask if, a word that has transformed in pronunciation from one era of humankind to another, is it still the same word? Well, kind of, yeah, kind of, no, but it doesn't really matter because it was just made up to begin with, right? It was the idea of a word is not the word itself. The word itself is the shared action of creation and understanding of meaning. And the idea of a person is not the person itself. You and I have minds that create concepts based on, our associative understanding of things. And so we see a person like me, and both you and I have this shared sense that, well, here's the same person as it was, a few months ago. And yet, in many ways that would both be measurable and probably only subjectively apparent would be there are many aspects of me that are different than they were several months ago. The idea that whether I am or am not the same person is really like asking, well, is it the same wave, 1 mile out of shore as it is a half mile out from shore? It kind of it is, but it's probably all different molecules, and it's has been fed by different action tendencies from the operations of, millions of factors in the environment. And so what we look at, even at the simplest level with colors in the environment or sound, the sound that we hear of each other's voice, hear our waves moving through the air and being converted by technological equipment into, digital form, and then reconverted by analogical technology back into sound waves for people to listen to. And the wave that we listen to, what we call a sound as though that were a thing, is actually a reverberation through the entire space that we occupy. Isn't that interesting to think about?
It's interesting. I'm going back to the wave idea. So the cause of the wave might be wind or an earthquake, an ocean. There's some motion that sets it off, or the gravity or the pull of the moon. And as we're talking about this, and what you mentioned before, we're part of the Big Bang. So the Big Bang started and sent waves through time, and we're still there. We're still reverberations of that. But I guess my mind is going to, so in the case of our physical reality and our existing psychological reality as well, what's the origin? I've thought before, in a simplistic way, I have this idea that our minds transmit our consciousness from outside of us. It's universal conscious or something to that effect, which is, I guess I'm asking you, what do you think, where does this all, is it beginning somewhere?
You mean consciousness, or
sure. some stuff.
Existed.
Well, we said the Big Bang was the beginning of a physical, maybe a physical being, but I guess I'm trying to separate the psychology. Maybe I shouldn't, but it seems to me that's still a mind-body separation, perhaps. And maybe that's a silly question, but what's besides the Big Bang, or which we think is a hypothesis, we don't know for sure that's how the universe started, but do you think there's a separate beginning to our conscious awareness of the I?
You know, that's a fascinating question. As you're bringing it up this way, you know, with reference to the kind of Cartesian split, the mind-body split, you know, I think, therefore I am, which modern science and medicine and psychology have largely relegated to an artifact of perception, where it appears as though my mind and body are separate. But actually, in every discernible way, the mind and body are co-emergent properties of some greater underlying reality. And I have the sense that the same is true on a larger scale, that we think about, well, first came physical reality, and then at some point consciousness emerged from that in some way that we don't yet understand. But I don't see why that would need to be true. And I suspect that the physical universe and the conscious universe are co-emergent in the same way that mind and body are co-emergent.
On that note, we'll come up on our first break. I have lots more questions for you. This is Centerpoint with Dr. Ron Unbar.
Coming attraction, Life Guide for Teens, Harnessing Your Inner Power to Be Healthy, Happy, and Confident. A new book by Dr. Ron Unbar to be published early 2025. Dr. Ambar's renowned counseling practice, Centerpoint Medicine, doesn't fix teens who are struggling. They give them the tools to heal themselves and support them while that healing happens. Life Guide for Teens will share Dr. Ambar's tools for self-empowerment and give teens hundreds of tips to choose from to help themselves heal. The book will be available from Amazon and wherever fine books are sold.
HealthyLife.net, where positive overcomes negative.
Healing and changing children's lives with hypnosis is very real and very possible. Dr. Ron Ambar's new book, Changing Children's Lives with Hypnosis, provides you meaningful stories and expert explanations to show you not only the process of hypnosis, but its many benefits for overall wellness. Whether a parent, practitioner, or medical doctor, this book opens the way to complete connection, so necessary for healing. Get your copy of Changing Children's Lives with Hypnosis at Amazon.com or visit DrAnbar.com.
HealthyLife.net, where positive overcomes negative.
Dr. Ron Unbar and his dedicated team of healthcare providers offer unique health services to help patients overcome psychological roadblocks or use the power of their minds to improve their overall health and well-being. At Centerpoint Medicine, with services in La Jolla, California and Syracuse, New York, this caring staff are waiting just to help you. Find out more at CenterpointMedicine.com. Can't wait? Make your appointment now. Call 858-201-4001. That's 858-201-4001.
Audiobooks gives you instant access to over 50,000 of the bestsellers and hottest book titles in romance, mystery, fiction, and many other genres. Just visit HealthyLife.net's advertiser page and click on Audiobooks to get started.
HealthyLife.net, where positive overcomes negative.
Welcome back to Center Point. I'm your host, Dr. Ron Unbar. Our guest, David Godot, a psychologist. We've been talking about Buddhist psychology and whether there is truly an I. How do you use this kind of approach, David, Buddhist psychology approach, in your therapeutic practice? How does it inform what you do?
That's a great question. I think it, you know, in order to answer it, we can look to the traditional methods of Buddhist teaching, which tend to be a shared inquiry and a pointing toward the reality that is ignored. So let's say I sit down to meditate, and my intention is to pay attention to whatever's happening in my mind. But I find very quickly that rather than paying attention to the mind itself, I'm swept away in the products of my mind. I find myself living in some alternate reality, having some sort of a daydream. And there comes this moment of awakening where I realize that this has taken place. And I try to get a handle on, well, wait a minute, what actually happened there? Because this is the nature of mind. This is how my mind works, is sort of creating an experiential reality that is absolutely convincing and absorbing. And it is only upon awakening that I see, oh, I was having a dream. I don't know if you have this experience with nighttime dreams as well, but I sure do, where I find that I have the strangest, you know, most kind of surreal and abstract experiences. And while I'm going through them as the dreamer, I have no sense whatsoever that I'm involved in a dream. It's only upon waking that I say, oh, wow, that was very strange and unusual and unlike my waking life. But in the moment that I'm experiencing it, my mind just makes sense out of it. And oftentimes I'll have a sense of history as though, you know, things have always been this way. And I have this vague recollection of knowing the people and characters surrounding me and the landscapes surrounding me. And this is, you know, something that we know that the brain does a lot of, confabulating. We perceive what we perceive in the moment, and to the extent that we have some sort of access to associative memory that relates to it, we'll pull that out. And to the extent we don't, we'll just make something up, you know, like the dementia patient who has no ability to encode memory about what they ate for breakfast. You'll say, what did you have for breakfast? And I'll be quite certain in telling you, oh, I had waffles and eggs. And they might have had oatmeal. They have no idea. But they're certain that they did because their mind has produced this very convincing memory. And I go through all this because I think that the very same thing is true in psychotherapy and in our relationship with ourselves and with our emotional lives. We live in this series of memories and dreams about what life is and about what it means, and we have no idea that we're producing a large portion of it, that we're confabulating and filling in the gaps, and we have no idea that we're still involved in the habitual learnings of our earliest days as sentient beings. And so oftentimes I'll be sitting and meditating, and I'll notice all of a sudden, wait a minute, a part of my body is tense. And I had no idea that it was tense until just that moment. And I'll have to really sit with it for a long time before an answer starts to emerge about how is it that I'm holding on to something in this part of my body. There's some action tendency, right, in a muscle contraction. I'm doing something physically, and I didn't consciously have any intention to do something physically, and I didn't have any awareness that I was doing something physically. What is going on there? And invariably, these subconscious contractions of the musculature, I think, are what Wilhelm Reich referred to as the character armor. We each have a characteristic way of holding our bodies in order to meet the world and protect ourselves from perceived threats. And what we perceive as being welcome things to move toward or threatening things to move away from, we learn very early on, and we develop these sort of habits that become ingrained because our nervous system is very repetitive. It's long-term potentiation. Neurons that fire together wire together, and so I am a system of habits of organisms, and by exposing these habits of organismic response to consciousness, I can create a little space where there becomes a vulnerability of the associative network to new ideas and new possibilities. And So most often what I'm working with in therapy is people coming in who are riddled with anxiety, depression, traumatic memories that are intrusive, fears that follow them everywhere. And I never find that those phenomena are limited to outside of the therapy room. A person comes and they sit down with me in the therapy room complaining of all these things happening out in their everyday life. And I can almost invariably find examples of where they're happening right in the here and now. And so that's what I essentially commit myself to do when someone walks in, is to pay as close of attention to this particular moment that we're sharing together as I can, and to see what happens between us. Where are the moments where you seem to retract, either from me or from yourself? And are you aware that that's happening? And how does it play out? What defensive strategy do you use? And if I can bring this to your attention so that we can understand it together, then that space is opened up to where there can potentially be new options to recognize this moment as distinct from the moments that taught this series of responses originally.
So let's say you have a patient, client with intrusive thoughts, and they're having them as you speak with them. How would you create that space? What would you tell them?
So for me, the question is, why now? Those intrusive thoughts, how do we understand the fact that they're coming up at this particular moment? Well, here you are talking with me, a person, and being near another person and interacting with another person brings up feelings. And what kinds of feelings come up in this situation that might be connected to those intrusive thoughts? And what happens to those feelings and those physical sensations as the intrusive thoughts come up? And typically what I'll see is that the intrusive thoughts are in response to a feeling of closeness to either a memory that's coming up or an internal reality, a sense of self, or to the feeling of being close to another person, to me. And the thoughts are a way of defending against that feeling, because this is a feeling that doesn't feel safe. I don't know how to tolerate this. This might be overwhelming. I might not survive this. My identity is at risk. And so the intrusive reenactment takes place as a preservation of the sense of self, the self-concept.
So you're harkening back in the sense that the symptom is a solution. The intrusive thoughts are solving something for you.
Yes. Absolutely. Milton Erickson, the symptom is the solution. If we can find out what the problem is, then we can open up space for it to be understood in a new way rather than simply responded to robotically.
Yes. Well, we'll be right back right after these messages. This is Centerpoint with Dr. Ron Anbar.
Make-A-Wish has been granting life-changing wishes for children and families for over 40 years. A wish is something that gives children the opportunity to look outside their illness and restore a sense of childhood back to the child. With the help of donors and more than 43,000 worldwide volunteers, Make-A-Wish has collectively granted more than 520,000 wishes worldwide. Dr. Anbar has referred many patients to Make-A-Wish. To make a donation, go to worldwish.org. That's worldwish.org.
HealthyLife.net, the positive radio network.
Healing and changing children's lives with hypnosis is very real and very possible. Dr. Ron Anbar's new book, Changing Children's Lives with Hypnosis, provides you meaningful stories and expert explanations to show you not only the process of hypnosis, but its many benefits for overall wellness. Whether a parent, practitioner, or medical doctor, this book opens the way to complete connection, so necessary for healing. Get your copy of Changing Children's Lives with Hypnosis at Amazon.com or visit dranbar.com.
Reach your health and fitness goals. Whether you want to lose weight, learn to dance, build muscle, or just live healthy, Beachbody gives you unlimited access to the nation's most popular fitness and weight loss solutions. Visit our advertiser page and click on Beachbody now.
Dr. Ron Ambar and his dedicated team of healthcare providers offer unique health services to help patients overcome psychological roadblocks or use the power of their minds to improve their overall health and well-being. At Centerpoint Medicine, with services in La Jolla, California and Syracuse, New York, this caring staff are waiting just to help you. Find out more at centerpointmedicine.com. Can't wait? Make your appointment now. Call 858-201-4001. That's 858-201-4001.
Welcome back to Center Point. I'm your host, Dr. Ron Anbar. Our guest, David Godot, who is teaching us about Buddhism, Buddhist psychology, and how to incorporate it into therapeutic practice. So, as we were talking, we mentioned that we are part of the environment. You know, we exchange molecules, we breathe in oxygen, put out carbon dioxide, and other things nourish us and make us who we are. And you're suggesting the same is true about psychology. And I'm wondering, when you're faced with another person, a client or a friend, how are we integrated? Are we the same? Or are we both part of the environment? Are we like the same entity but different parts of it? How do you think of different people coming together?
You know, it's interesting because I think there's a lot of different ways to look at that. You know, from an organismic perspective, there is a clear division between the two of us. And yet, humans, particularly as, you know, pack animals, have an inbuilt interdependence, a natural set of drives to affiliate with one another and to integrate with one another. And I think that's the outward manifestation on a psychological level is culture. We, as more than, you know, as two or more people come together, over time we develop both literally and figuratively our own languages, our own customs, our habits. And I think those habits develop very similarly to what we're talking about as individual habits. You know, the responses to the environment become integrated into this associative network. And people respond to one another in incredibly fine-grained and almost imperceptible ways. Milton Erickson, who we mentioned, made an extensive study of what he called minimal cues. What is the least amount of output, communicative output, that I can direct towards a person that will elicit a response? And he found that the more minimal the cue, the more powerful the response. Because it's the more minimal the input from the outside entity, the more the individual mind sort of confabulates its own self-determination and says, well, I'm not aware of anything influencing me to do this, and so therefore it must be all mine. I came up with this, you know. And I think that this really points towards the question of free will in a very tangible way, because we like to believe and think of ourselves as having this sense of self-determination, of I guide my fate based on my preferences and, you know, am able to take responsibility. And there was a recent article in the International Journal of Clinical and Experimental Hypnosis that was wonderful, actually. It was on hypnosis and free will and consciousness, and had a lovely literature review of the consciousness research regarding this sense of free will that has largely concluded, you know, as a consensus that the sense, that the subjective feeling of having free will is almost entirely illusory at every level. That for things as simple as how to move our bodies or whether to move our bodies, and for things as complex as, you know, charting our path through life or choosing spiritual beliefs, all of it seems to originate preconsciously in facets of our minds that we don't have any conscious access to or awareness of, or ability to consciously influence in the usual ways that people would try to consciously influence themselves. And so the argument that this paper made was that, you know, as one of the distinguishing features of hypnosis is this sense of involuntariness. And there's often what we call volitional avolition, right? So I'm suggesting that you move your arm. And you have this sense that you kind of choose to let that happen. So it's volitional. But also, as it's moving, there's a feeling that you're not actually the one doing it. So it's avolitional. And the argument that this paper made was that the feeling of choosing is itself illusory, and the hypnotic reality, where we experience our movements and thoughts and reactions as being essentially involuntary and part of this ongoing unconscious flux, is more accurate than the normal waking state of consciousness. And so that the hypnotic state is a better representation of reality as it is than what we normally experience.
So as an example of that, I had a patient who was very gifted at hypnosis, and he could negatively hallucinate. He could take an object that was there and imagine it's not there. And I gave him the suggestion that there was a trash can in the middle of the room, and I said, you can't see what's in front of you. And then I asked him to get up and walk towards me, and he went around the trash can. I said, why did you go around that spot? He said, oh, there was a smudge on the carpet. His reality was he didn't see the trash can, but
right.
Consciously, but yet reacted to it and made up a reason, which we know conscious people do. They make up reasons, even though the subconscious reason might be different. However, that being said, as you know, I do a lot of work talking to the subconscious, using hypnosis, mm-hmm. talking to this other entity. And I think it's subconscious because it has the same overlay as like dreams. You'll come out of a subconscious experience and sort of remember that you forget it quite quick. Or as a subconscious may be telling me things that when you're in your normal state of awareness, I don't even know. And I remember telling you this. I might not have even known this about myself. So I do a lot of that work.
Yeah.
And I give the subconscious input, and then it'll be carried out consciously, and the conscious person says, I don't know why I'm doing this, but I know we could be talked about it. So I'm wondering, when you talk about free will, I agree with you that conscious doesn't have a lot of volition, but the subconscious, whatever that is, seems to have volition. What do you think about that?
I think it's a question of volition from where? What is the origin? And this goes back to the idea of where is the locus of self? Is that something separate from the environment? Can we meaningfully distinguish organism from environment? Or are the phenomena that we're consciously witnessing actually far more integrated than they appear, than we imagine them to be? And when we look at, you know, unconscious action, where is the source of unconscious decision making? Every experience I've ever had has been a learning experience. And in the sense that, you know, is, again, we kind of reify this idea of learning as though, well, here I'm internalizing some piece of information. But we know that people primarily learn experientially. Any experience I have is more likely to be repeated subjectively. And because my neurological system is a system of repetitive association. And as those associations strengthen, they become more likely, and permutations within them sort of begin to evolve organically. And I think if we think of our decision-making process in that way, as, well, how do I learn how to behave? I learn how to behave by seeing other people in the environment behave and watching their movements and watching their choices and watching where their eyes move and what they tend to look at and what they tend to view as being salient or important to them. These are things that my mirror neurons kick in and begin to internalize, and I engage social learning to the extent that it feels safe to do so in the environment. These observations become internalized as a part of me. And this process of constantly evolving behaviors and perspectives has been going on as long as there have been humans. Every generation passing down a variant of the last generation's ingrained set of associative, mechanistic behaviors. And likely, you know, before there were ever humans, we probably share learned perceptions and behaviors from, you know, from time as single-celled organisms. All passed down through an infinite variety of permutations and successions into something that is so complex that there would be no conscious apparatus which could possibly tease it all apart. And yet, we must make sense of our lives as we live them for various reasons that I don't think we fully understand. But for some reason, it's very important for us to do so because we have these powerful minds that are willing to observe all of the data and make up the best explanation that we have. And that enables us to solve a lot of problems, but it also enables a lot of perceptual illusions.
Right back after these messages, this is CenterPoint with Dr. Ron Unberg.
More than 30,000 children and adults of every race and ethnic group in the U.S. have cystic fibrosis. Cystic fibrosis is a disease causing long-lasting lung infections, limiting the ability to breathe over time. Dr. Anbar participated in research that helped advance survival of cystic fibrosis patients by more than 20 years. He encourages you to donate to the Cystic Fibrosis Foundation to help find a cure. It's easy to donate. Go to cff.org. That's cff.org.
HealthyLife.net, the positive radio network.
If you are a medical or licensed healthcare professional or just anyone looking for a qualified hypnosis practitioner, then go on over to ASCH.net. That's the American Society of Clinical Hypnosis. At ASCH.net, you can get certified, attend workshops, and even find a hypnosis practitioner or consultant. ASCH provides an opportunity to learn and interact with colleagues. So whether you're a professional wanting to learn hypnosis or a patient wanting help with a problem, visit ASCH.net now.
Constant Contact and your small business make a perfect fit for marketing. They give you what you need to succeed. Fast and easy email marketing at your fingertips. Visit the HealthyLife.net advertiser page and click on Constant Contact to start your marketing.
Healing and changing children's lives with hypnosis is very real and very possible. Dr. Ron Ambar's new book, Changing Children's Lives with Hypnosis, provides you meaningful stories and expert explanations to show you not only the process of hypnosis, but its many benefits for overall wellness. Whether a parent, practitioner, or medical doctor, this book opens the way to complete connection, so necessary for healing. Get your copy of Changing Children's Lives with Hypnosis at Amazon.com. Or visit dranbar.com.
Radio your way. HealthyLife.net.
Welcome back to CenterPoint. I'm your host, Dr. Ron Unberg. Our special guest, David Godot. We're talking about the mysteries of consciousness and free will and the I. And in the last segment, we spoke about how people interact with one another. I've had the sense, David, that when I'm with somebody else, especially if I've connected with them before, that a different entity is formed. There's something else between us that doesn't exist independent of us. What do you make of that sensation, feeling?
Oh, I love that observation. I think that matches my experience as well, that I often find myself a sort of overly simplistic way of putting it would be to say, well, I feel enriched when I'm interacting with certain people, as though my mind were more expansive than it ordinarily is. And I think, you know, kind of what you're alluding to there is when we come together, here's this experience of transcendence. I'm not so limited when I'm interacting with someone whose experience, you know, has enough variance from my own that it adds something, but not so much variance from my own that there is resonance, you know, between our experiences, that there's not an immediate discord. And it does feel like the creation of a larger entity. I've experienced that with larger groups as well, where, you know, several people in a particular circumstance that's very, you know, conducive to an expansive state of mind might bring about a period of profound learning and change and growth for everyone involved, and the development of insights that are shared among the participants but very difficult to verbalize by any of them.
It's fascinating. In Judaism, they require 10 people to be praying together to be an appropriate group for prayer. And I also recall the opportunity one time in my life of leading in prayer a congregation of 1,000 people in the high holidays back when I was in Boston. And the 1,000 people didn't seem like individuals. It seemed like its own entity. It's just a really interesting experience, perhaps in combination of all we're talking about in terms of the environment and how we influence each other.
It reminds me of that feeling that you get in your body, you know, this sort of pinprick feeling of hearing multiple voices harmonize perfectly, especially if one of the voices is yours, to feel that sense of resonance come over you is very difficult to describe. I think that's what you're kind of talking about.
I believe so, but interestingly, what we're talking about right now is when we're together physically. I wonder if we can spend a few moments talking about in our new post-COVID world where people interact by video and then the physical interaction is very different. How does that affect, do you think, what we're talking about then?
Oh, man, what a big question. I don't know that that's something that we can address in a couple of minutes, and I don't think there are clear answers. I think it's something that a lot of us are really wrestling with right now, because it's clear, you know, since the dawn of the information age, which has so transformed our societies, our individual consciousnesses, that there is both the thrill of rapid and available connection with others and the danger of, how can I think about it, of almost of desensitization, and also of loss of a certain level of organic resonance. You know, when, you know, studies have shown that when we share a room together, we physically come into alignment, our heart rates come into alignment, our rate of breathing, heart rate variability, and we share neurosteroids that we excrete through our breath and through our sweat that impact the neurological functioning of everyone else in the room. We come into alignment in terms of brain waves. And I don't know that anyone has done research to find out to what extent those effects are present in a conversation like this where we're talking by voice. Or where we might only be communicating by text, what are the implications for our sense of connection? And thinking more about everything we've been talking about with kind of the mind's tendency to confabulate, to what extent do we experience a sense of community and connection that the brain has sort of made up that actually puts us more at odds and more out of step with people when we encounter them in the real world? Could we be creating our own isolated universes of consciousness that it's more and more difficult to bridge the gap between?
A virtual reality of sort, isn't it? But
yeah.
I am aware of a study of people playing the same video game in different locations, and their brainwaves being aligned, even though they're not physically present with each other. I guess they're present video game world. So we're complicated creatures of humans.
That is fascinating and encouraging, you know. And I think I have had that experience of having a sense of connection across time and space, you know, via these information technologies. And I think there's, it is a question of how much is genuine, how much caution needs to be exercised. Because, you know, in psychotherapy, you can sit a couple feet away from someone and be sharing the same room and talking about very deep things and come to realize at a certain point that, oh, wow, we've actually been occupying very disparate realities without having any idea. We thought we knew what each other were talking about, but it's come to light that we did not at all, and our subjective experiences of this were very different. And often that, what's called in attachment, you know, based therapy, rift and repair of recognizing where we've been misaligned and finding the reattunement, is where the relationship is built, is where healing happens and the sense of being able to connect to others takes place. And I wonder how much of that can and does happen through electronic, you know, at a distance media, versus how much, we sort of project onto one another and, you know, transfer our expectations out into the universe. Probably has something to do with depth of experience, like playing like you're talking about this study, playing an involving video game. You're not heavily intellectually involved with each other, and you're sharing a direct experience. Probably stimulates more of this sort of resonance than more intellectual discourse. Fast-moving, you know, current events-related discourse that we see as, you know, I see as being so readily divisive. The discourse becomes so toxic so quickly in the modern social media sphere. And I wonder if that has something to do with it, something about the nature of the connections that we form and the opportunities available. I wonder if we could create medium, online media that were specifically tuned to enhance interpersonal connection and resonance and spiritual connectedness, rather than to push us apart.
You know, you bring up excellent questions, and thank you so much for the very stimulating discussion. And as I have often found with deep subjects, the more you go into them, the more questions you have. So, well, I feel enriched. I have many more questions than I had at the beginning of this hour. Thank you for sharing this time with us, David.
Well, thank you so much for having me on again, Ron. I really enjoy talking with you. I wanted to mention, if it's okay, I'd love for people to drop by my website, davidgodeau.com. I'm going to be adding a lot of content there in the coming weeks, including my new podcast, The Depth Psychologist, where I'll be talking about issues of psychology and spirituality and the occult and how things connect in unexpected ways.
Wonderful. And David Godeau is spelled DavidGodeau.com.
That's the one. Thank you, Ron.
Absolutely. This is Centerpoint with Dr. Ron Anbar.